Greetings and welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I am this week's producer, Jeremy Roth Cushell. In beginning to critically deconstruct the key role of the Anti-Defamation League in the Israel lobby, I speak with Jewish-American journalist and pro-Palestinian activist Jeffrey Blankford about his work to expose the ADL and its collaborators for colluding with apartheid Israel and South Africa on espionage against civil society in the United States, hoping to further understanding Israel-Palestine beyond the walls. This is Jeremy Roth Cushell with Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls. I'm joined today by Jeffrey Blankford. Jeffrey Blankford is a radio producer, photographer, and journalist of Jewish-American background who has been a pro-Palestinian human rights activist since 1970. He was formerly the editor of the Middle East Labor Bulletin and co-founder of the Labor Committee of the Middle East. He was also a founding member of the November 29 Coalition on Palestine and the Palestine Solidarity Committee. He won a settlement from the Jewish Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, in February 2002 for its vast illegal spying against him, as well as hundreds of other progressive social, political, labor, and environmental organizations, and thousands of individuals, including anti-apartheid groups and activists. Blankford's articles have appeared in Counterpunch, Dissident Voice, and Mondo Weiss, among many others. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jeffrey Blankford.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Your biography says that you have been a pro-Palestinian human rights activist since 1970. Where were you in 1970, and how did you become a pro-Palestinian human rights activist?
I was in London in 1970, and I was waiting to hear about a possible trip to Sardinia, where there are a number of U.S. bases which Americans don't know about. Some Italian activists wanted me to go and document their existence with my photographs, but I hadn't heard from them. When I got a call from David Fenton, Liberation News Service in New York, asking me if I would be interested in going to Lebanon and Jordan with the founders of Liberation News Service, George Cavalletto and Sheila Ryan, new photographs for a book they were going to do on the Palestinian struggle, and if being Jewish, did I have any problem with that? And I had no problem with that. I didn't have any affinity to Israel. I was very much impressed and depressed by the Holocaust, which happened when I was growing up, but I never transferred my feelings about that to Israel. And my early experiences with people from Israel were negative, and that they told me these were Jews who had emigrated to Israel, who came back very soon, visited my parents and told them that they couldn't live in such a racist place, that every time a Palestinian who had lost their land came back and maybe launched an attack on a Jewish settlement, they would have what they call pogroms. That was their term, pogroms against the Palestinians who remained. And that made an impression on me. I was a teenager. And in 1966, when I first went to Europe, I ran into Israelis who had left Israel for the very same reason, because they didn't want to live in a racist country. There was no PLO at the time, no discussion of things like Intifada. It simply was a racist state in Israel. The Palestinians were living under military control until 6 months before the Six-Day War. So I didn't have any problem with going to visit with Palestinians. It intrigued me, actually, although my interest up to that time had been working against the Vietnam War and photographing the Black Panthers. So I went and spent 4.5 months in Lebanon and Jordan. In Lebanon, at refugee camps where people came from 1948, and in Jordan, mostly came after 1967. But I had a moment when I was standing on the border between Lebanon and Israel, looking down at a Jewish settlement where, it turns out, my sister's ex-brother-in-law was living. And I realized that here I was, a Jewish American with an American passport in my pocket, standing between two young Palestinian men who were born in Palestine. And I had a right to live in that country, according to its laws, where these two young men who were born there did not. And when I came back, I told people that was immoral then, and it's immoral now, and there's no way to erase that immorality. And so I came back. I went to Jordan. I spent about 4.5 months between Jordan and Lebanon in different refugee camps taking photographs, and only left when the head of the PLO in Amman told me that King Hussein was going to launch attacks in the refugee camps and that there'd be no photographs because his troops would kill anyone when they saw on site. And I never saw any photographs from the Black September. And so I left and went to Beirut. I was in Beirut when it started. I came back. I had been living in Europe for a year and a half. I came back to the United States and decided to focus on working for Palestinian rights and justice.
Before we focus on the Anti-Defamation League and specifically your direct encounter with it legally, but also as a target of apparently illegal espionage, before we get into the background facts and logistics of that, why do you think that the ADL spied on you, among others, in collaboration with foreign state intelligence services from apartheid governments in South Africa and Israel?
Well, our Labor Committee on the Middle East, which was co-founded with Steve Zeltzer, a longtime labor activist, also Jewish and anti-Zionist, was the first and remained the only organization around the Palestinian cause that focused on Palestinians not as victims, but as workers, and also addressed the problem of the AFL-CIO as has been a cornerstone of the Israel lobby since the Zionists first appeared on the scene, before there was an AFL-CIO. The labor movement of the United States is unique in the world, but is the only one whose officials back Israel to the core. And I read an article in the Hadassah Courier, Hadassah Women's or Jewish Women's Organization, that Stephen given me. The very first paragraph said that in the lobby of the AFL-CIO building in Washington, D.C. is a bust of Golda Meir, the former Israeli prime minister. And the writer said, that's natural because next to the organized Jewish community, the biggest support for Israel in the United States is the labor community, which has purchased millions of dollars of State of Israel bonds, among other things. And the author of that article was Wolf Blitzer, who went on from there to go to AIPAC and then now on CNN. So you have somebody, literally an Israeli establishment person in a key position in CNN. When I read that article, that convinced me that Steve was right, that we need to start a labor committee. And so half a dozen of us began this committee. And our first protest was to protest the appearance of Willie Brown, the Speaker of the California Assembly, very prominent, powerful position. And he was speaking at the annual luncheon of the Histadrut, the Israeli Labor Federation, which has had an office in San Francisco at the Service Employees Building, and was being criticized in Israel at the time for its ties to South Africa. And we staged a very successful protest, got bad publicity for Willie Brown as supporting apartheid Israel, and that forced the Institute office to close and move out of San Francisco. Our very first meeting, Roy Bullock showed up, someone who I knew casually, who was a member of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, board of directors, actually, not an Arab, and who also was active in anti-apartheid activities. And one of the groups he was working with was Free Moses Mayakiso, as a South African trade unionist, which Steve was very much involved with. So Steve had mentioned to Roy Bullock, that we were going to have this first meeting of the Labor Committee on the Middle East, and Roy wanted to come. So he was at our first meeting. And obviously, this would be a major interest and concern of the Israel lobby, the Jewish establishment, because labor was something that they guarded very strongly, and they made sure all the labor unions were lined up behind Israel. And very early on, maybe after a month or so, I got an anonymous piece of mail, which was a tear sheet publication of the Institute for Historical Review, a Holocaust denying operation. But what it said, there was a whole article about Roy Bullock saying he had been a spy for the Anti-Defamation League for the previous 25 years, that he would come to their conferences soliciting a membership and distributing literature for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Well, that anyone with a half a brain would know the last place their Arab American community would want to solicit support from is an organization that basically exists to deny the Holocaust. And so even though I questioned the source, I didn't question the information. And so I called Roy Bullock and told him I wanted to meet with him. And Steve and I met with him at a cafe in the San Francisco Mission District. And I showed him the article. He looked at it and I said, well, what do you have to say? He said, it's not true. And then I asked him, why are you interested in working for the Palestinian cause? And he made a crazy answer. He said, well, I had a brother who worked in Saudi Arabia. Oh, that explains it. And then I asked him, as I'd done some research, how he managed to keep turning up at Palestinian events all around the country. And he said, well, I'm an art dealer, and I just happen to travel around a lot. And by coincidence, I'm in these cities when the events take place. And I said, you have anything to back that up? He said, I'll give you references. And he gave me references of two art galleries, which are the TGLs in San Francisco. And fortunately, I kept that piece of paper with the names and phone numbers. This was 1987. So in December 1992, when I read San Francisco policemen had been arrested for illegally spying, getting information on the Nation of Islam. I had a hunch there was some kind of connection there. So I called the San Francisco Examiner reporter who was covering the story, and I asked him if the name Bullock meant anything to him. And he said, boy, does it. All I have right now is the last name. And so I gave the information to the art dealer. This story broke. ABC came and sent a cameraman out to San Francisco to follow Bullock on the streets. I got attacked by the Jerusalem Post, Washington Jewish Week, Jewish Forward, and the Wall Street Journal for being part of a red-brown coalition exposing this great human rights organization called the ADL. I decided that I needed to tell other people in the movement, other organizations, that I believed that Bullock was a spy. Steve and I talked to each other after our meeting with him, and his excuses or his reasons for supporting the Palestinians didn't wash, particularly as he described why he was visiting all these cities when the Palestinian meetings were taking place. So we tried to warn other groups, and nobody wanted to hear from us. They attacked me for spreading false rumors, and then he kept on doing the work he did, including becoming a volunteer in the Office of Mobilization, the Socialist Action. It was going to march on Market Street in 1988, a big march, where he was able to get all the mail that came into the office, one of which was a number of petitions that we had organized to get the Intifada, First Intifada, mentioned on this march. A demand list, because here were all these leftists claiming to be anti-Zionists who didn't want to mix the Intifada with any other political issue they were raising, such as peace, jobs, justice, and so on. So we got a petition together and got 3,000 signatures, and I would send them by registered mail into the office of the mobilization, not knowing that this Roy Bullock was working in that office. This is despite my efforts to expose this guy. And so every name that came in on the petition became a member of the Emergency Committee for Palestine, which never had a meeting. And they ended up in the ADL files. This is something that only one of the people from those days who criticized me for spreading the rumor at Bullock ever bothered to apologize. But this was an example of how the movement allowed itself to be used by the ADL. And in our case against the ADL, they weren't very supportive.
How were the logistics of the ADL's role in this spying campaign organized? And this is just one of multiple times of spying. Then what was the response specifically in terms of this spying campaign that you helped expose when you helped expose it?
Well, this was a major embarrassment for the ADL because they had not just pro-Palestinian groups. They had a whole section on anti-apartheid organizations, but they had every organization that could possibly take a position on Israel. The Asian Law Caucus, one, immediately canceled a program that they were going to have with the ADL. And the ADL wrote them a letter criticizing them for doing that. No apologies on the part of the ADL. Irish Northern Aid, Latino groups, MECLA, NAACP. There was not a single organization that could possibly have taken a position on Israel publicly, did not have a file on them. And the ADL tried to explain this all away. First of all, they initially said that this guy Bullock was operating independently. But then it turns out he had been paid by the cutout in Beverly Hills, a Beverly Hills lawyer named Bruce Hockman, who died a couple of years ago, for 25 years, thus avoiding the ADL then violating the law by not treating him as an employee and paying the taxes on him. Bullock also, we learned, was doubling as an agent of the South African intelligence, working with the same cop, Tom Girard, and getting paid by turning over information on the anti-apartheid movement to South African intelligence agent who is based in San Francisco. And in the deposition, Bullock said, it wasn't any more work for me. I was already doing that for the ADL. So here's the ADL already working with South Africa, collaborating with South Africa, even before Bullock came on the scene. And an interesting thing to show the connection to Israel was during our depositions, Pete McCloskey, our lawyer, who was the only one who would take that case, I should say, he had also been targeted of the ADL, former congressman. He brought Victor Ostrovsky, a former agent from Mossad, down from Canada for a deposition at his Redwood City office south of San Francisco. And Ostrovsky didn't really have much to offer in terms of our case, but was really interesting. Whereas the ADL lawyers had been very friendly to me and to Steve, Ostrovsky, they saw daggers, and immediately they asked him to turn over to them, the ADL lawyers, the documents he had taken with him when he left Mossad. Now, if you want any more proof for a connection between the Anti-Defamation League and Israeli intelligence, that was it, because they would not have made such a request had they not been asked to do so by the people paying them, which was the Anti-Defamation League.
And you've referred to this legal process and of your lawyer, Pete McCloskey, who was not just acting as your pro bono lawyer, but was also a target of the same spying campaign. So can you tell us why you, along with a small group of others, filed suit against the Anti-Defamation League? Was it a simple matter? You refer to Pete McCloskey as your lawyer, but weren't there other teams of well-funded nonprofit, pro bono, liberal-minded civil rights lawyers lined up competing to represent you in your matter?
That would be a cartoon. Challenging Israel in court is a career-ending decision. And in terms of Pete, he was told later on by lawyers who he had helped and he was going to go into partnership with that they had been warned they better not do it. And the lawyer who Pete had helped apologized to Pete, but it was a matter of a career. Pete's now 92. He's just recovering from a stroke. He's one of the bravest people I've ever met. He was a Marine and fought in Korea, then went back to talk about it, testified about the atrocities committed against the Koreans by the U.S. Marines. He just did things that he thought were right. He spoke for the Palestinians because he thought it was correct to do, and he did that in Congress, and when nobody else would do it, when no Democrat would do it, for sure. And he's just... my father once told me the reason he could not support Israel is that he didn't keep a double set of books, one standard for everybody. And that was Pete's standard, and it still is. And I go to visit him every couple of years or so. He doesn't live that far from me. And this is who he is. Without him, we would not have had a lawyer. There was a lawyer that represented a number of other organizations in a class action, which we joined in on. But the lawyer really could have been working for the ADL. I never heard of the lawyer. I was not involved in hiring him or consulting, even though we were the ones who exposed the ADL. We were excluded from that part by these other organizations, which, as far as I'm concerned, were infiltrated by folks close to the ADL. And he made a deal with the Los Angeles police in which the ADL agreed to pay some kind of $25,000 for sensitivity training for their cops. And in San Francisco, we got no legal support other than Pete McCloskey. The other organizations that claimed to be anti-Zionist would be out proclaiming their support for the Palestinians were nowhere when it came to this issue. And finally, when a group did form, there was a meeting of all the groups who had been spied on. We had no input into this group, but the person running it was the head of the Middle East desk of the American Friends Service Committee, who appeared to be an Israeli agent, very close to Yasser Arafat, would not allow any Palestinians on the Middle East committee of the American Friends Service Committee in San Francisco, Northern California. And he would go over and visit Arafat in Tunis and come back and say what Arafat wanted to be said, and almost approve it when the Arab presidents of the Arab organization, Palestinian organizations, wrote a long letter to Arafat in Arabic, but I saw the letter. They sent it over to Tunis to Arafat complaining about this fellow and never got an answer back. Well, the answer, we did get an answer, a photograph of Salamanov and Arafat arm in arm. In any case, this meeting came together of all the groups, Irish Northern Aid, Asian Law Caucus, and labor people and so on, and decided they would have the first meeting. First subject would be on anti-Semitism. It blew my mind, and I realized that this was part of their game, just like when Jewish Voice for Peace started in Berkeley, and I heard they were monitoring me because of my obsession with Israel lobby. The first thing they did was publish a book on anti-Semitism. This is what we're dealing with and still are dealing with.
Before we finish up by asking you your general assessment of the role of the Anti-Defamation League in the Israel lobby generally, I want to finish up in terms of your legal case, your campaign to hold the ADL accountable while also exposing the truth about it, by assessing both the pressure that you were under to accept such things as non-disclosure agreements all along the way that would have prevented our conversation actually right now, where you're disclosing this history. And then additionally, will you speak to the physical and political context that surrounded Roy Bullock's spying, both in terms of South Africa and apartheid intelligence actions? Chris Hani was assassinated after a trip that he had taken to the United States, where he had apparently been spied on. And then Arab activist in Southern California, Alex O'Day, was killed in a bombing. And now no specific allegations have been established in relationship to a connection between this ADL spying campaign and these actions. But this general physical and political context here is inevitable to discuss.
Very good question. First, I would say that our suit was filed in 1993 and not settled until 2002, when the state court demanded we either go to trial or settle. And what had held up the settlement is our refusal to sign a non-disclosure agreement, our refusal to keep silent about the case and what we had found in the case. And finally, the ADL, on the Friday before we would go to trial, the ADL sent a settlement over to McCloskey, and in the settlement, it was a non-disclosure agreement. Pete called them on the phone right away and said, our clients are not going to sign it. You better get another one over here without it. They had one already ready to go. And so that enabled me to be on the radio up here for 19 years. I had a program up here and talk about the case. And when people would ask me, why, how could I get away with talking about the Israel lobby in Israel the way I did, I would tell them simply because I refused to sign a non-disclosure agreement because they didn't want me to tell you, the listeners, and then I would tell them about their spy spying South Africa and also having the key and floor plan to the office of Alex Oda, the head of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Orange County, who was killed by a terrorist bomb when he opened his office one day. And the fact that the ADL spy had a key and a floor plan to his office should have been something that would have caused a major investigation. That never happened. As far as Chris Hani goes, Chris Hani would have been the successor to Nelson Mandela and far better than any of those of his successors. Chris Hani was followed on his tour of California by Roy Bullock, the ADL spy, by the way, who should have been forced or prosecuted for working as an agent for a foreign government. But that only happens to people who our government doesn't support. In any case, shortly after Hani returned to South Africa, he was assassinated. But he was obvious. He was an enemy of the ADL, an enemy of Israel. And Israel was very conscious of his support for South Africa, how controversial it was. And that's why they managed it also to persuade in various ways for the Congressional Black Caucus to not say a word about it. And this is why you ask what the ADL does. ADL gets information to use for blackmailing members of Congress or ordinary citizens who might otherwise say something that might be dangerous to Israel. As a matter of fact, when our case started, Roy Bullock, when he came to our committee, the first time he saw me at the deposition, he said to me, ah, Steve Kaiser. And I used the name Steve Kaiser for my telephone bills and my PG&E bills, but I rented my apartment under the name Jeff Blankford. And I said, yes, go ahead. He had gone through my mailbox. But this is what they do. They go and spy and do the kind of things that private eyes do. And Bullock was named by Irwin Sewell, who was the head of the ADL spying operation, as his chief backbinder, period, in the United States. We learned in the case that this is a national spy network by the ADL. They had a spy like Bullock in Atlanta, and they had another one in Chicago. Those names never came out. And he also, Bullock said that he had a half a dozen people working for him in the San Francisco Bay Area. I have suspicion of one of those persons who I've accused of being that, but those names never came out. So now the files are buried and the files are sealed.
The ADL continues to proclaim itself to be a Jewish civil rights and anti-hate group organization. What do you think the ADL is and does and why? And what role does it play historically and in the current moment in terms of the Israel lobby and in the Jewish Zionist power establishment more generally?
The ADL has played a critical role through the years of even before there was a state of Israel. The glue that holds the Jewish community together, by and large, is anti-Semitism, real or imagined. So the ADL has a history of polling Americans virtually to see what their feelings are about Jews. They ask these questions like, do you think Jews have too much power? And if you say yes, you're an anti-Semite. If you say no, you're an idiot. But in any case, their role is to keep anti-Semitism in the news one way or another. So you have all these hate crimes listed against Jews. But if you go through the list, you see drawing of a swastika on a wall is a hate crime. Someone writing the N-word about blacks on a wall is not a hate crime. Hate crimes are very important in terms of headlines, getting people to believe that Jews, despite their positions in power in the United States and their obvious power, positions of power, are eternal victims. That despite the fact that every time Israel launches an attack on the West Bank or Gaza, and the protests of Israel rise corresponding to the violence perpetrated by Israel on the Palestinians, these are considered hate crimes and anti-Semitic. And on the basis of this, these organizations raise money, they continue funding their operations, and make the organized Jewish community, those affiliated organizations, fearful that another Holocaust is around the corner. And even when they know there isn't, as a matter of fact, it's interesting, they were among the perpetrators of the belief in 1967 that Egypt was going to come through and wipe out Jews and have another Holocaust. It was known that there was no chance of that in Israel. There was no chance of that, none. But at that time, Jews had lost interest in Israel. More Jews were leaving Israel and emigrating there. And Israel's economy was dead in the water. I remember reading the newspapers back in 67. So what they did was what other countries have done in a desperate situation. They started a war. And the triumphalism in Los Angeles, where I was in 67, even for someone who was not at that time that interested in the subject, was so obscene. You would think that the people in North Hollywood and Beverly Hills had been in the battlefield. But that was so effective. They have meetings of all the Jewish organizations every month in Washington, the major Jewish organizations, to plan their strategies. So it's not just one group deciding to do this, another group deciding to do that. It's all coordinated. So, for example, there was a writer named Leon Uris who was Jewish, but he wasn't particularly interested in Israel. They sent him to Israel to write the book Exodus. And then their friends in Hollywood made the movie Exodus. You couldn't buy the kind of publicity that was for Israel. Paul Newman became the hero of Israel. When the famous journalist Martha Gellhorn, who had covered the Spanish Civil War, was also a Zionist, she went to Israel just after it became a state. And she wrote an article in the Atlantic magazine after speaking with Palestinians who still remained. And it was so supportive of Israel and so critical of the Palestinians as if these people were primitive. It was difficult, since I had respected this woman, I read the article, I couldn't believe that she had written it. The Zionist organization sent a copy of that article to every person in the United States in the book Who's Who. Their propaganda operation is extraordinary, and the ADL had been a key player in this, probably the key player for years, particularly in its connections to Israel. Now they're under attack because they're not pro-Israel enough by right-wing pro-Israel groups, but it's all in the game. You can't take these criticisms seriously.
This is Jeremy Roth-Kushel with Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls. I've been speaking with Jeff Blankfort, Jewish-American radio producer, photographer, and journalist. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jeffrey Blankfort.
Thank you very much for having me as a guest. Be well.
You too. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.